This little light of mine.
Welcome to This Little Light of Mine, the podcast where we explore what happens when you teach a child that they are not allowed to love. Here's your host, James Powell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 24 of This Little Light of Mine. My name is James Powell, and I'm so glad that you're able to join me for today's story episode called Toxic Outing. Since my last story episode called Validate Me, I've had yet another personal reminder of how strong and addictive the drug of validation can be in my own life. On the night before the US inauguration, many social and racial justice accounts on Instagram suddenly and without warning disappeared, and my @mylightshinesbright Instagram account was one of them. In an instant, the community and mental health platform that we've been building to talk about religious trauma, LGBTQ2S+ inclusion, and anti-racism was gone. It just disappeared. My panic and anxiety were instantaneous, and I watched my reaction move quickly from shock to shame. Phase 1. Question and deny reality. What happened? How could this happen? This can't be happening. This has to be a mistake. What do you mean there's no human support for Instagram? There must be something I can do to fix it. Then on to phase 2, shame and blame spiral. I must have done something wrong. I attach so much meaning to the growth of this community. What will other people think? How can I hide this? I'm going to be seen as a failure. I have nothing without this. What will I do? But then, a new phase appeared. This phase 3. This mystery phase where I started to breathe, accept my feelings, be with these feelings, share these feelings, and start to discover that I'm not defined by these feelings. And while this experience continues to be extremely frustrating, it's been an important lesson of sitting with and sharing some of my inner feelings. What I'm learning is that when I bring some of my internalized shame and anxiety out into the light of day, I'm able to explore a healthier path forward. I'm also learning that all of my thoughts and my feelings are valid. I don't have to do this on my own, and I'm surrounded by people who want to help. And I have the internal resources to handle whatever comes across my path. And on that note, a big thank you to those who reached out and said, "Where did you go?" and checked in to see if I was okay and to share some experiences that many others have been going through with social accounts being disabled. Now, in today's story, I take you back to another point in my life where I didn't think that I had the internal resources to handle whatever crossed my path. For many queer children, the act of coming out and declaring that they don't fit the expected and assumed heteronormative mold can be a process that is fraught with shame, anxiety, and in some cases, fear of physical harm and abandonment from those closest to them. For the majority of my childhood and teenage life, coming out to my family was an impossible obstacle that I did everything to avoid. And with that, here's today's story episode called Toxic Outing. My final year of university seemed to go on forever. I'd just moved back from studying abroad in Hong Kong, and I only had 4 ridiculously unimportant half credits to complete before I would officially graduate. Now, every personality profile or assessment has always clocked me appropriately as being the guy with a huge vision, quick to innovate, pivot, take advantage of new opportunities, extremely competitive, incredibly sensitive, and harshly critical on myself. These tests also consistently say that follow-through on details, compliance, and listening to authority aren't necessarily my strong suits. And this made my final year of studies extremely difficult for me. I kept focusing on what a complete, utter waste of time, money, and energy it was. And yet the competitive part of me, it didn't let me stop driving to be in the top 2% of my graduating class. At that time, having the words "with high distinction" on a piece of paper that nobody would ever see was of the utmost importance to me. My internal pendulum kept swinging back and forth between hovering over the drop program button on the university's registrar site and spending an insane amount of time cramming so that I would ace every single project and every exam. We were approaching midterms at the fall semester, and my parents reached out and invited me home for a visit. They mentioned something about coming along with them to some church fundraiser thing, and then spending the night at home. I hadn't seen my family in a while, and felt obligated to accept their invitation, and I told myself, well, at least you'll be able to visit some of your friends from high school, if I was going to spend the night. As the weekend approached, I learned that we were going to a fundraising dinner for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Ravi and his family went to our church growing up. His wife was the director of my children's choir, and we would go to Sunday school with his kids. I never really followed Ravi's ministry as it grew, but I knew enough that he was no friend of Dorothy. I want to pause here to give you a brief edit of Ravi's thoughts on my problem of homosexuality. The next 4 minutes is an edit from a longer Q&A that Ravi shared with the world. Before we continue, I want to provide a severe trigger warning as I consider this conversation an example of hate speech and religious abuse. If you do choose to listen to the next 4 minutes, I want to ask you to pay attention to the following. Listen to how Ravi uses his leadership and academic persona to intellectualize LGBTQ2S+ humans into being a problem, or three problems as he shares. Hear how he doubles down on the sacredness of race, ethnicity, and sexuality, but he completely skips over the history of Christians using the Bible as justification for slavery and genocide based on race. He also shares how marriage is the most sacred relationship that one can enter. He implies that LGBTQ2S+ relationships cannot include agape love, God's love, and without that, he claims that eros, or romantic love, is gone. He literally says, LGBTQ2S+ relationships cannot include God's love. Here's Ravi.
You know, how do we deal with this very trying social issue of our time? The homosexual lifestyle and all that has come about in our time, how do we as Christians deal with it? I'd be a dishonest person if I said to you that that question doesn't worry me, that I don't even think about it. Let me give you about three panels of an answer. The first panel is the logical problem. The second panel is what I call the theological problem. And the third panel is what I would call the relational problem, how you communicate it to you. The reason we believe that discrimination ethnically is wrong is because the race and ethnicity of a person is sacred. You do not violate a person's ethnicity and race. It is a sacred gift. And the reason we believe in an absoluteness to sexuality is because we believe sexuality is sacred as well. And that's why we make our choice that same way. Marriage, as God has given it to us, and if you take the whole corpus of the worldview, is the most sacred relationship into which you will enter. Because love is given one word in English, but there are four words in the Greek. Agape is God's love. Phileo is friendship love or brotherly love. Storge is protective love or parental love. Eros is romantic love. I said, do you realize marriage is the only one that pulls these four together? Agape, phileo, storge, and eros. I said, and if you take agape out of that, eros is gone. For whatever you want to do. Romantic love becomes redefined. And to us, the Bible gives the sacredness of marriage as Christ is to the church, the bridegroom and the bride. And in that sacredness, the beauty of a consummate relationship between a man and a woman, as it is shown in the singular commitment of the marital vow, I do and I will. When you say I do to the one, you say I don't to all of the others. And you say, I will to one, you're saying, I won't to all of the others. So any departure from that beauty and sacredness of the four confluences of love is a biblical notion of what it really means to be married. And to just take one behavior and make it look like it's aberrant is not right. All departures from that are not acceptable in the sight of God. The theological position is a consummate relationship between a man and a woman in the procreative act and in the sacredness and paying each other the ultimate compliment of taking each other at their word. So theologically, this is the way we see it. Sociologically, we've been put into a conundrum. So we come then in relationally, how do we deal with it? And here's the hard part. And my wife will tell you this, others will tell you this who know me. The consequences are bound to the choice. And you go right back to the book of Genesis, and it tells you, you do what is right, will you not be accepted. But if you don't, sin stalks at the door, desires to have you. And so when I look at the sacredness of marriage, any change from it, from the biblical point of view, is a departure from the biblical mandate. But at the same time, the Bible commands us to love even those with whom we disagree. And our responsibility as the church is never to hate the individual. Our privilege is to love. And only God can change the heart of a person. And God is the ultimate judge. And in a pluralistic society, let us as Christians be both light and salt and learn to love one another. And let God be the judge over all of us. He is the one who is pure in his judgments. We can make errors. Those are the three panels I want to leave with you.
So what do you think? What did you think of his definition of the sacred marriage vow and how it's a procreative act between a man and a woman? When you say I do to one and I don't to all others? And that any departure from this is not acceptable in the sight of God? So I had a few questions. If you're not procreating, you're not acceptable to God? Does this mean that God finds the pill, condoms, or any other safe sex methods unacceptable? I guess this would extend to find any tubal ligations or vasectomies as unacceptable as well. We better get on those reversals, people. And what about couples with no children? Is their union not biblical? And is it unacceptable to God? And what really irks me is how he wraps this up with saying, how do we deal with it? I'm not an it. My loving isn't a problem. Your homophobia and misappropriation of my God is the problem. But he wraps it up, oversimplifies things, and says, we love the sinner, but hate the sin. We'll love you, but we'll continue to believe that God can and will change you. We'll also believe that sin stalks at your door, as he says, and is ready to take you to hell. But hey guys, let's love everyone. To me, this is the toxic theology that hurt me and is continuing to poison our children and their parents today. And as history shows us, it ends up that Ravi was a very dishonest person who didn't come near to practicing what he preached. In fact, he and his organization went to extreme lengths to shun, silence, pay off, and discredit anyone who tried to share his actual human practices. I've put the link to Ravi's full talk, along with links to what's going on with Ravi's ministry, in the show notes for today's episode. Okay, enough on that topic for now. Let's get back to today's story episode. The other information that my parents shared with me, we were going to Ravi's fundraiser with another church family, and that they were bringing their daughter along. My parents seemed oddly eager about me having the chance to catch up with Rachel. I can't remember a single thing about the fundraiser that night, other than the extremely awkward ending. As we were getting ready to leave, my dad turned to me and asked, "Is there somewhere that we can drop you kids off on the way home?" I must have looked at my dad like he had three heads, glanced over at Rachel to confirm that she had no idea what was going on, and then replied, "What on earth are you talking about? I just thought you guys might want to grab a coffee or some dessert and catch up some more." What in the world is my dad trying to do? The last thing I wanted to do with the rest of my night is to spend more time carrying on this church charade. I'd already devoted 3 hours to rubber chicken, polite conversation, and pretending to be engaged. It was time to get home, get changed, borrow the car, and head out to see some actual friends. "No thanks, Dad. I've made plans with friends at home." Rachel looked relieved at my decline, and I thought that would bring a close to this portion of the evening. But it didn't. My dad, in his familiar, relentless salesman style, continued to push. "You're sure? We can drop you at a Starbucks, a diner, or maybe some sort of cafe." With this extra push, I could feel my entire body tense as memories of what it was like growing up in our house flooded into my mind. I recalled the years of strict compliance and where I felt like my every movement, choice, thought, and belief weren't my own. After living away from home for 4 years, my dad was still trying to control my actions. "Yes, I'm sure," I said as I clenched my jaw. My dad looked back at me and said, "It doesn't have to be a long thing." The anger inside of me was erupting, and the lava was pulsing through my veins. I don't know how I maintained my composure. "Dad, I'm sure. Let's go." "Fine, but don't say I didn't ask." The entire car ride home, I was enraged. But like always, I did my best to keep that inside, as my mom played peacemaker and tried to make polite conversation by asking what I thought about the ravi portion of the night. My typical one or two word answers soon turned to silence as we listened to the radio and made our way home. As soon as we arrived home, I grabbed my bag out of the car, ran inside, greeted our family dog, and ran up to my old room to get changed before heading out for the night. Coming back downstairs, I tried to be as casual as possible by asking, "What car could I take out for the night?" The response from my dad knocked the wind out of me. "Before you go, your mother and I would like to talk with you about something in the front room." Nothing, I mean absolutely nothing good, ever comes out of talks in the front room. 13% of me was pissed because I had plans with my friends. 17% of me annoyed. But 70% was absolutely terrified. We all walked into the front room, and as my mom closed the French doors behind us, I knew that I had walked into a trap. I was locked with my parents inside a comfortable yet airless tomb. I sat in a chair facing my parents, who sat on opposite ends of the sofa on the other side of the room. With one glance at my mom's already watering eyes, I knew that I was about to be devastated. My father started out with the words, "We have reasons to believe that you may be struggling with same-sex attraction." Hearing those words, my entire body went limp, and I immediately started to cry. The moment that I had been dreading and dodging for years had finally come to be. There was no escaping this moment. There was nothing that I could say. There was nothing that I could do. My tears had admitted my guilt, and all I could do was sit there and wait for what was next. My dad went on to explain that while I was away in Hong Kong, that I had called home to ask for some sort of insurance number that I had written down in the reference pages in the back of my day timer. I immediately realized my fatal error, and thinking back, if only iPhones had been invented 15 years earlier. While on that phone call from Hong Kong, I had directed my mom to the box that I had packed my planner into, and told her to open the back cover and that the information I needed would be easily located. As the story was told to me, the planner accidentally fell to the floor, and when my mom picked it up, she couldn't help but read what was on one of the pages. Being young and in love, or so I thought, I had used my day timer as a diary where I would document all the new things that I was doing, trying, taking, and experimenting with my first boyfriend, Hugh. Yeah, my parents had both pored over all of that deeply personal information and had kept it to themselves for months in preparation for tonight's private family outing. My mind was spinning in a million different directions. I was enraged at the violation of my privacy. I was trying to rewind and review all of the conversations and visits that we had had since they had found out. It had been months. I was ashamed and embarrassed that my parents knew all that they did about me. But most of all, I was scared for what was going to come next. My memory of the rest of the conversation is blotchy at best, but there were many words exchanged that were permanently tattooed on my soul. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words, they can cause a lifetime of trauma. Here's a sampling of what I remember. This is the most hurtful thing a father could ever learn about his son. Do you know what this will do to our family? Can't you see how this is already killing your mother? Have you considered how this will destroy your career and all that you've worked for? Do you still consider yourself a Christian? How? After these initial rounds were discharged into my being, my dad reloaded, and both of my parents started a new line of questioning. Why didn't you come and speak to us? Is this because I wasn't around enough when you were younger? Do you see me as an absent father? Is this because I was always there? Do you feel smothered by me? Was I an overbearing mother? Did something happen when we left you in the nursery at church? Did somebody touch you? Remember that odd babysitter who spanked you without our permission? Does that have something to do with this? Do you remember that? At last, the questioning had finally come to an end. I was numb, weak, and exhausted, and just needed to get out of the house. Can I just go? Go? We haven't even begun to address how we're going to deal with this problem. My parents started to open up about the research they had done on this topic. The others in our church and in our past churches that they had reached out to for advice, and how that had helped to inform them on creating their initial containment plan. Yeah, containment plan. Like the plans put in place when a nuclear reactor leaks. To my family, I was now toxic. What was of paramount importance was that nobody needed to find out about my same-sex attraction. My parents were aghast to learn that I was fully out to my friends at university, all my colleagues at work, and to most of my friends from high school. I was quickly and forcefully informed that this type of openness did not fit within the Powell family containment plan, and that my shameful secret was not going to be shared with my sister, my brother, my grandparents, any extended family members, or anyone else from within our church community. Fine, can I go now? I still wanted to borrow the car, and I knew that this was not the time to push back, argue, or heaven forbid, stand up for myself. But then again, I was never permitted to argue, share my actual opinion, or use my authentic voice if it didn't align with the black and white views of our fundamentalist beliefs. My father was the head of our household, and when these decisions were made, that was it. Before you go, we need to pray and ask God to help us through this challenge. Is he serious? I couldn't imagine anything that I would want to do less than listen to my dad speak to God and beg him to intercede on this challenge. I tensed up my body even more, dug my toes as deep as I could into the carpet, and waited for this spiritual abuse to finally end. And it did. You can go. And with that, I was released. I grabbed the car keys and headed out to see my friends. I have no idea what we actually did that night, but the one thing I do know for sure is that I would have never mentioned a single word about the hell that I had just endured. It was time to wipe those tears away, shove all of those emotions back down inside of me, plaster my plastic smile back onto my face, and be the James that all of my high school friends expected me to be. A few weeks later, I was obliged to return home for Canadian Thanksgiving weekend. My plan was to keep all family time to a minimum. Once again, I'd asked to use the car so that I could go meet up with some friends who would be home for the holiday. I was given permission as long as I picked my sister and brother up from their shift at Dairy Queen and dropped them back home before going out. I agreed and was out the door. I picked up my sister and brother, and as I was driving them back home, my sister shared two words with me. "We know." Part of me knew exactly what she was talking about, and yet another part of me knew how adamant my parents were about not letting my dirty little secret be known to others. Know about what? About you. About me what? Oh, Jim, about how you're struggling with same-sex attraction. I froze, focused on the road, and didn't say another word for the rest of the drive home. I do remember my sister saying something about how she still loved me. My brother agreed, and as they got out of the car while I dropped them home, I do remember feeling some sort of support. The next morning, I confronted my parents, and I asked them how they could have betrayed my trust again, and wanted to know why they felt it was their place to share such an intimate part of me with my siblings, especially after they told me I wasn't allowed to share it with them. My father reminded me that he was the head of our household, and reiterated that we are a family that doesn't keep secrets from each other. And after my father said that, my mother invited me upstairs, saying that she had something to show me. We walked upstairs and into a spare bedroom. She closed the door behind us and pointed out a massive white Bristol board that had been affixed to the back of the door. And that was the first time I laid eyes on the Circle of Gay. Now that was my pet name for this project, not theirs. This piece of contemporary art was very functional and very simple. Staring back at me was a massive circle with my name written in block letters in the middle of the circle. Surrounding my name, but still within the circle, were the names of my parents, my sister, my sister's best friend, my brother, and my brother's best friend. My mom explained that every member of the household had been instructed to consult the Circle of Gay each morning. They were to study the names within the circle so that there would be no confusion and no accidental sharing of my secret. The Circle of Gay was a containment and tracking device. The Circle of Gay was a physical manifestation of my family's shame over who I was created to be. Oh, it's been an emotional roller coaster writing and recording this episode. I didn't realize how much shame, hurt, and pain that I'd been holding on to for so many years. This is a hard episode for me to share because of the indoctrination of family honor and silence that was a central part of my religious upbringing. So many of us have been taught, if you don't have anything nice to say, then don't say anything at all. We're also implicitly and explicitly told what goes on inside of a family system needs to stay inside of a family system. Remember that commandment, honor thy mother and father? That's kind of what this implied for me. In trauma therapy, I'm learning how this form of silencing is part of my core wound. As a child, my young mind felt that speaking my truth and coming out of the closet would have ended in being kicked out of my family and living on the streets. I see how this core wound has continued to impact my life, and I get re-traumatized in situations where I'm forced or coerced into being silent. I've learned that this silencing or staying in the closet is part of what keeps the cycle of abuse continuing. Silence breeds shame, and shame breeds more abuse. Now, as I say this, I want to be sure that I'm not shaming or pressing anyone to come out before they feel safe to do so. Only you know your personal situation, and your personal safety needs to come before all else. That being said, a common trauma response for victims and survivors of child abuse is called parentification. This is when the victim of abuse takes on the emotional responsibility of their abusers. This role reversal sees the child victim or survivor acting as the caregiver for their adult abusers. Now, parentification doesn't only happen in childhood. Parentification creates a state of chronic stress and relational trauma and shame that can extend for a lifetime. This same type of chronic stress happens in workplaces, relationships, and politics. It's part of the abuse of power, and one reason why more people don't speak out. I could see the impact of parentification show up for me with today's episode. As I shared my truth, I wanted to hold back and protect my parents and my family. I struggled with sharing my experiences because I didn't want my parents to experience any pain, shame, or judgment. I was trying to protect them. I was trying to be in the parent role. And I can see how parentification has spread into other parts of my life too. At work, with doctors, therapists, government officials, tax people, or anyone that I believe has power over me. Growing up in an extremely religious environment taught me that I need to protect those in power. They come before me. Speaking up, speaking back, questioning, or not believing was not tolerated. Control and compliance were prioritized and expected. I learned early on that my feelings, my desires, and my voice had very little worth. And in some instances, my desires, I was taught that they were sinful. As an adult, I'm learning the consequences of not coming out. When we don't share who we are, when we hide, suppress, and deny our truth, we get sick. This is the reason we shop, eat, sleep, drink, sex, please, Netflix, spend, drug, game, work, perform, Instagram, cut, or porn ourselves to death. We are attempting to emotionally numb, escape, and deaden ourselves from speaking our truth. Coming out isn't a one-time event for queer people. Coming out is an ongoing process of truth-telling for every single human. Coming out is a continual mental health imperative for each and every one of us, all the time. We need to continue the work to encourage, protect, and share movements like Black Lives Matter, Indigenous Reconciliation, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Me Too, corporate whistleblowing, reporting of church, sexual, emotional, and spiritual abuse, and all other causes that encourage humans to speak their truth. These movements need to be viewed as vitally important, and they need to receive priority funding for their mental and whole health impact in our world. When we say things like, let's talk, and ask, how can we move the dial on mental wellness? Well, these are some of the movements that need to be top of mind. They're not just social justice movements. These are mental health movements. They're people saying, I haven't been listened to, and I need to be listened to. These movements are important mental health movements of humans saying, I need to be seen, and I need to be heard. And we must protect our most vulnerable. We must fight for and create protections for our children who do not have the resources to speak their own truth. Our children rely on the protections of their caregivers. But what happens when our caregivers bring these children into harm's way? For me, and for many other queer children, harm came in the form of homophobic and hate-filled theology of the church. We currently have zero protections, warnings, guidelines, regulations, or anything to protect children from this abuse. Our society continues to look the other way while this abuse continues to happen in plain sight. And guess what? It's funded by your tax dollars, by my tax dollars. So what about you? What truth have you been holding back or hiding? Are there places in your life where you need to come out? Speaking your truth is not toxic, but the impact of hiding your truth, it may be. As they say, we're only as sick as our secrets. Thank you for joining me today, and before I go, I want to remind you that you have a powerful voice that was designed to be heard. Our world needs all of you, and we need to hear your truth. And only you can tell that. Until next time, be safe and know you are loved.
Thanks for listening to This Little Light of Mine. To learn more about our guests today and for links from our show, visit www.thislittlelightofmine.ca. If you enjoyed this episode or feel that it could bring love and acceptance into someone else's life, please like, rate, review, and share so that we can build our community and bring more love into the world for all people. Thank you for sharing your time and listening to our stories today. And we would love to hear your story too. Visit the Get Involved section of thislittlelightofmine.ca to share your voice. We love being in community with you and look forward to sharing more with you next time. Now go and let your light shine bright because you are loved.